Good morning. Wednesday morning Bible study on the Gospel of John. We're in chapter 11 now. And if you remember last week, we started chapter 11, did about the first half, so we'll continue on. Chapter 11 is the story of Lazarus. And this is the only place in the Gospels that it exists, is in the Gospel of John. So just to kind of bring you back up to speed a little bit, after Hanukkah, the Feast of Dedication, which is in December, Jesus had retreated to the far side of the Jordan. At least some people knew where he was. So Mary and Martha sent word to him that their brother Lazarus is ill. Jesus was friends with them. We know that he had visited with them previously a few times. So he gets the word that Lazarus is ill. What does he do? He stays where he is for an extra 2 days. Very strange. But he knows what's coming. He knows what he's going to do. And then you remember we talked about, he says to his disciples, Lazarus is sleeping. Let's go and awaken him. And they don't understand. And so then he changes and tells them plainly, no, he's dead. We're going to go wake him up, or let us go and be with him. Lazarus has died. Which, by the way, I think is a wonderful way for Christians to think of death, like sleep. St. Paul does that too, in a couple of places in his letters. Those who have fallen asleep, Paul says. I think that's a comforting way for us as God's people to think of death. All right, so then he's approaching Bethany, where Mary and Martha are, and Martha comes and sees him, and she says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. Yes, a little bit of an accusation. Remember that? It's going to come up again today in the next section that we go through. Yeah, a little bit of an accusation there. A little bit of tone, I would say, in her voice. We can kind of sense it through the words. And Jesus says, your brother will rise again. She confesses right there in verse 24. She says, yeah, I know he'll rise again in the resurrection on the last day. Some of the Jews, like the Pharisees, did believe in the resurrection on Judgment Day, and some did not, like the Sadducees. And that was one of the disputes between those two groups. So she says, yeah, I know, on Judgment Day he'll rise. Jesus says to her, so this finishes where we were last week, and then we'll get started. Verse 25, I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. First of all, wonderful statement there. We use that in funerals all the time. I am, so that's the ego I me statement. That is the I am, that is the Greek translation of the Hebrew name Yahweh. So yes, Jesus is right there saying in a fairly obvious way, if you understood the Hebrew background, he is saying Yahweh, I am. And what is he? The resurrection and the life. Where does all life come from? It comes from God. And what is the enemy, the number one enemy of God and humanity? Death. And who is the only one who can overcome death? Jesus. And he's the resurrection. That overcomes death. That's the solution to death, is resurrection. And then, just to remind you, we talked about this briefly last week as we were wrapping up. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. So you will be raised from the dead. And then Jesus says, everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Well, wait a second. You just said, though you die. Whoops. It's a touch screen here. All right, there we go. So Jesus says, though he died, and then he says, shall never die. What does this mean? That could be a source of confusion for some people, or a source of criticism for non-Christians looking at this. You know, it's a contradiction. Now, remember we talked about John, the Apostle John, is also the author of the book of Revelation. And in Revelation, he talks about the two deaths. And those who are believers in Jesus, while we would be subject to the first death, are not subject to the second death. That gives us a clue here as well. John got that from Jesus. What is Jesus referring to? The first death is physical death. We all still must die, yes, unless Jesus comes again first. But we all must die, but it's not the end. We will be raised. What is the second death in which you shall never die? Eternal death. Right? Damnation and condemnation and hell. And Martha finishes with this wonderful threefold confession. You are the Christ, the Messiah, the Son of God, who is coming into the world. Remember, the whole main theme around the Gospel of John is, what is the identity of Jesus? And here, yet again, like in so many places in this Gospel, there's an indication of the identity of Jesus. He is the Messiah. Yes, there's still confusion. What does that mean? But he's also the Son of God. Remember, previously, Jesus referred to himself as the Son of God. A change, because he usually said Son of Man. So Son of God is a little bit more clear that he's referring to himself as divine, who is coming into the world. But someone last night asked the question right here, before we then continue on, who is coming? Isn't Jesus already there?
He's coming again.
Second coming.
Who is coming? Coming again. Second coming. I hadn't thought of that, but that could be a reference to that. What is the point of Jesus? Why is he coming?
To save the world.
Save the world. Save us from our sins. How will he do that?
By dying on the cross.
By dying on the cross. Has he done that yet at this point?
Not yet.
No. So his purpose is coming. It's not there yet. He is standing in front of Martha in the flesh as a person. So he is, you could say, has come into the world. He was born as a human. He's there. But his purpose has not yet been fulfilled. So his full purpose is still yet to be fulfilled. Who is coming into the world. Okay?
My Bible says was coming.
Really?
Yes, it does.
What translation?
NIV.
Oh, that NIV.
Okay. Shame.
NIV isn't too bad, usually. The original NIV. The later editions of the NIV got worse. So, it should be future tense.
It's
coming.
It's a Concordia self-study Bible.
Yeah.
NIV.
But they have to use the NIV as it is, just like in our ESV Bibles. Okay. ESV isn't translated by Lutherans, so we have to use the ESV for copyright, even though we might say this wasn't quite translated right.
So is better than was.
Yes. Yep. Okay, then verse 28. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and is calling you." All right, now first of all, did Jesus actually say, "Go get your sister Mary"?
No.
We don't know. Might he have gestured or said something and it didn't get recorded in between verse 27 and verse 28? He might have. We don't know. Or Martha might have just assumed, since Jesus was there, he'd want to talk to Mary also. It doesn't really matter. But she goes and fetches Mary and says to her in private. Now, we don't read anything into, remember from last week, the fact that Mary went out to see Jesus as he was coming, and Martha went out to see Jesus, and Mary remained. That the simple answer is just they weren't together when news came, hey, Jesus is approaching. Martha heard, she went out, Mary was elsewhere in the house or out in the garden or whatever. And so she hadn't heard it. So, verse 29, so when she, Mary, heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews, who were with her in the house, consoling her, saw Mary rise quickly and go out, they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now, actually, Dr. Weinrich in the commentary, one of the commentaries that I'm reading, makes the point, other commentators make this too, that if Martha happened to have said something to Mary publicly for all to hear, oh, Jesus is coming. He wants to talk to you. Come out with me and we'll go back and talk to him some more. The other mourners who were there comforting Mary would have probably said, oh, okay, and done what? Stayed where they were. So the fact that Martha said this to Mary privately caused the mourners to say, oh, I wonder where she's going. We better follow. And as a result, they became witnesses to the event that was about to happen. So again, this is just kind of coincidental, not coincidental, maneuvering of the events by the Holy Spirit, I would say. Now, back then, they had mourners that would help console a person who's grieving. Kind of like we do when you have visitation at a funeral home, right? People come and, you know, give you a hug, say a kind word, or just be with you for a little bit to help with grieving. But here's a question I want to pose to all of you. I actually wrote it down in my notes so that I don't get into lecture mode. We have a little bit of discussion. Okay? They were supposing she was going to the tomb to weep there. Now, in all the funerals I've done so far, I know some people who go back to the cemetery and back to the site of burial and, you know, maybe every year, take flowers, trim around, you know, make sure things look nice. I know other people who never go back to the cemetery. And it doesn't matter either way. Everybody grieves or mourns in their own way. How many of you have gone back to a cemetery, to a place of a loved one's burial? Does that help you grieve, and how so? So I'm just kind of posing that as a question, or, you know, get some thoughts or reflections from you guys. How many of you have gone back to the cemetery to visit a site of somebody? Oh, man, a good chunk, three quarters of you. Yeah. I would say on my part, yeah, go ahead, Sandy.
Well, we live kitty corner from a cemetery, and that's where all of my husband's family is buried. And so our children and grandchildren have been, because it's just, I mean, very walkable. Yeah, they've been there many, many times, and it's a chance to talk about, you know, what this one did. You know, this one was in the Civil War. You know, and I mean, you know, it goes way back. So it's,
wow.
It's, you know, it's a way to connect, you know, with,
sure, connect with history, family history. Yeah, I could see that. Sure. Yeah, Don.
In fact, in those days, didn't they have professional mourners?
They did sometimes have professional mourners who would come and weep with you or cry with you and help support you. Yeah, I know. How'd you like that job? I can tell you on my own, for my own self, I don't know that I've gone back to a cemetery for any relatives. You know, I've had, my grandparents have all passed away. I know where they're buried. We were there for the funerals. I was close with them, but they're not real local to me. They're all on the other side. I suppose for my parents, maybe I'd visit the cemetery. I suppose if my wife precedes me, I would probably visit the cemetery more often for her place of burial. So, you know, I would say maybe some of it depends on how close a person is to you. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Yeah. I don't go very often because I don't feel like they're there. Right.
Yeah.
So that's,
well, that's what I said. Some people don't. And you say, well, that's their body. That's not them. The soul is in heaven. Okay. Maybe for some of you, it dredges up old emotions that you don't want to confront. I don't know.
I think it gives you comfort. I think you have some happy memories.
Okay.
Especially if you've lost a child.
Well, see, that would be pretty severe, too. If I lost a child, Jill and I, then we would probably be at the cemetery more often for that, in that case, yeah. Right.
You have good memories sometimes,
sure.
And it gives you comfort to think,
sure,
that
it could.
Good times.
Yeah. Any other thoughts? Yeah, Mary?
Well, I grew up going to funerals and going to the cemetery, especially, you know, around Memorial Day, we would go to the cemeteries where my grandfathers were buried, and so, I mean, on both sides of my family. And now my parents, of course, are buried in Illinois, so I don't get there very often, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I do go to my husband's grave, which is right across the road here, you know, from time to time, whenever I feel I want to.
Sure.
But I don't talk to him there. Now, I have heard some people say that they go to a loved one's grave and they talk to that person. I don't do that.
Of course the person is not there,
not there,
and they're not going to hear you if you're talking to them anyway, but if it gives you comfort to kind of express your thoughts or feelings, there's nothing wrong with that. But no, they're not there. That's just the shell of their body in the grave, right?
I will say this too, that my granddaughter has been very interested, times that we have gone to Illinois, you know, together. She has been very interested in going to the cemeteries, like where my parents are buried,
mm-hmm.
and so on. And of course, the cemetery that's with the congregation I grew up in, that, you know, there are all kinds of people that I knew that were buried there, and she's very interested in those things. Not all young people, I guess, are.
Right. I will tell you, last night, Jen Steffens mentioned that when she was living out on the West Coast, I don't remember how long ago or for how long she was out there, there was a cemetery right next to where she lived, but there weren't any parks nearby. So she would go for a picnic in the cemetery. And I kind of said, that sounds a little odd to me, but I guess why not? She said, well, it's well maintained, the grass is mowed, there's flowers generally here and there. She said, it was a great place for a picnic. I was like, well, okay, I guess if you want to do that.
I think there's cultural differences between different cultures. We were in California, and we drove by a cemetery, and it was like a big picnic was going on. There were helium balloons.
Wow.
Lots of people, kids running around. And we were told that the Spanish culture, they go there to the cemetery to remember and celebrate.
Yeah, kind of that Day of the Dead thing
yeah.
that Latin cultures
yeah.
have. Yeah. Yeah, that would be a different cultural thing. Sure. Sure. All right. Well, just something to ponder. It doesn't really matter. But, of course, here they did sometimes go to tombs. Let me take this opportunity to take you on a separate field trip, not a discussion-based one, but the burial practices of the Jews. Okay? So, they would do two things. One of two things. If you were less well off, you know, maybe on the medium to poor side of the economic scale, you would do kind of, you know, what you might think. You would prepare the body, wrap it in linen with spices, and then you would dig a grave in the ground in an appropriate location. They would have designated cemeteries. And you'd bury the person in there, cover it with dirt. They would mound the dirt up and then whitewash the earth because you should not walk on it. Because that's disrespectful to the body, but also it makes you unclean by walking on top of a place where a dead body is. They might also put a marker there, so that's kind of the precursor of a headstone or a gravestone. Okay, so that would be one thing. That would be the cheaper alternative. If you were a little more well-to-do, you would carve out, or have carved out, a cave someplace. Usually it wasn't a naturally occurring cave. They would actually hire some workmen to carve out a cave. And inside that cave, there would be a bench. So the body would be prepared and wrapped in linen and put with spices. And then they'd lay the person on the bench and roll a stone against it. This was common. So this it all sounds familiar from what happens to Jesus. You know that. And then on the one-year anniversary, they would go back, roll the stone away, and retrieve the bones. Discard the linens. Retrieve the bones and put the bones in a ossuary, which is a bone box. And then that would also stay inside the tomb, maybe in another spot on a little shelf or a ledge. And they would, and then the bench is now available for, the next relative. They would use these as family or clan tombs. So you'd have generations of people buried in the same place. And they would all end up in a little bone box or an ossuary stacked on the other side or on a ledge or something like that. So you'd have that bench where they would lay the person. They did not embalm. Embalming was an Egyptian practice. So the whole purpose of the spices was to overcome any beginning odor of decomposition. And yes, Jews would try to bury the same day because they didn't embalm. So decomposition of the body begins within hours after a person dies. So the spices would kind of overcome the decomposition process for that day while they're preparing for the funeral and having the service and all of that. And then the spices would wear away and the person's body would decompose over the coming year. So that's the practice. Okay? You're going to see that here. This is another reason why I said last week that why we think Lazarus and his sisters, Mary and Martha, were a little more well-to-do. Because he has a tomb. Poorer people didn't have a tomb. They would be buried in the ground. Okay? Also, we know Jesus was buried in a tomb. And it says in one of the Gospels, a rich man's tomb. And it says in one of the other Gospels, I think it was either Joseph or Nicodemus's tomb. Their own tomb that they had carved out freshly for themselves, right? It was an unused tomb at that point. Okay, all that sound familiar?
Yes.
I don't remember which gospel said that, but I don't think it was in John, but we'll be getting there in a while. Okay, so that's a little bit about the burial practices. Now, nowhere in the Bible does it say you can't embalm. The Jews just didn't, for I think a few reasons, practical included. Plus, it was what they would call a pagan practice from the Egyptians. There's nothing wrong with us today embalming a body. What is the purpose of embalming a body? To prevent decomposition for a week or so, because generally in modern times it takes us that long to get a funeral organized. Okay? So there's nothing wrong with embalming.
When did they start doing that above the ground with that cement?
The tombs?
Yeah.
Oh, in ancient times. They had both practices all the way back to David and Moses and even before that. Both practices. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was part of the Jewish burial customs. Yeah. Okay? Any questions? Yeah, Ann?
Just a comment. I don't know if any of you have read A Skeleton in God's Closet, but what happens is you have...
Yeah, yeah.
And there is an ossuary found with bones in it, and I can't remember if there's an inscription on the box or whatever, but it's supposed to be Jesus.
Yeah.
And his bones are there. Mm-hmm. And so that's the gist of the book. You know, is this really Jesus? Is this, you know, is this a hoax, the resurrection? And you can find out if you read the book. But so that explains why there was an ossuary box with bones.
Yeah, right.
And they thought it was the tomb of Nicodemus. And
Yeah, right. It was an interesting book. I read that book, too.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was fiction.
It was fiction, yes.
Right.
Fiction, written by Paul Meyer.
Paul Meyer. It is fiction.
That's a good imagination.
Yeah.
Yes, I read it, too.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so continuing on, verse 32. Now, when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Oh, my goodness. Martha just said the exact same thing. And see, depending on how you read that, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Well, that's an accusation. "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." That's maybe less of an accusation and more just a statement of regret. Okay? Where is the truth? Well, we can't say what the inflection was here, but I definitely would say that the words, both Martha and Mary say these words, and personally, I would say it's a combination, a little hint of accusation, but mostly it's just a confession of regret that we wish you had been here, because then this wouldn't have happened. Okay? But yes, I think there is a little hint of accusation in their voices there, both of them, the sisters.
It's also a statement of their faith.
It is. It is a statement of faith as well. They know Jesus could have healed him. Yeah, exactly. All right, and she fell at his feet. That's a posture of, well, frankly, it's a posture of worship. It's a posture of reverence. So that says something, too, about how Mary and her sister Martha recognized Jesus and thought highly of him. And they knew he was the Messiah. Yes, didn't quite know what that meant. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." Jesus wept. Yes, that favorite memory verse of every confirmand ever. The trivia question is, that is the shortest verse in the Bible, right there. Jesus wept. They all know it. Of course. Now, I have to talk about two vocabulary issues here, translation issues. First of all, he was deeply moved. If you have a study Bible, it will probably say this footnote, or was indignant. I looked it up, and the word behind here, I didn't write it in my notes, the Greek word, can mean angry or indignant, but it can also mean agitated or upset. I really prefer, I think the context here is Jesus isn't angry. per se. Maybe he's angry at death for having taken his friend Lazarus, so you might say that. I think this is more that he's agitated or upset. He sees the grief of the people around him, the sisters and the other people, and so he's agitated or upset. And I kind of like the ESV translation here of deeply moved. You could substitute those two words for upset. He was upset in his spirit and greatly troubled. See, that would make sense. So I kind of like this. So the only reason I point this out is if you have a footnote in your study Bible that says indignant, I don't think that's a good translation. That footnote should have, I mean, it is true, the word can mean indignant or angry, but I don't think that's the sense here. Secondly, weep. The word weep. There are two words in Greek. The kruo, which means to shed tears. Or the word plio, which means to sob or bawl. To sob or bawl, meaning there's vocal sound. You know, a child gets hurt, and do you hear the cry? Yes, you hear the cry. You're watching a sad movie, and you got a tear coming down your face. But there's no, you're not making any noise, or, you know, your spouse isn't making any noise. It's just shedding a tear, okay? There's two different words in Greek for weep. Now, they both get translated here as weep, and they both exist here, by the way. Does it really matter for what we're talking about? No, but I'm just bringing it up to you because I found it interesting. Verse 33, when Jesus saw her weeping, the word there is plio, sobbing or bawling. Her grief was so much that it was coming out vocally. And the Jews with her also weeping. Plio is the word there. Again, sobbing or bawling. But then when you get to verse 35, Jesus wept. The word there is dakruo. Not that Jesus was openly sobbing or bawling, but that he shed a tear. You know, he had maybe a few tears running down his cheek from his eyes because he was so moved. He was upset in his spirit and greatly troubled. He was so moved that he's shedding a tear. Now, is there really a difference? Well, there is a difference, but does it matter for our story here? Not really. In either case, Jesus is sad and he's grieving with the sisters.
Well, it would seem to me that he would be grieving for them because he knew Lazarus was going to be alive.
Well, yes. I agree. I didn't say that quite right, yes. Because, you see, Jesus wept. It happens right after he says he was deeply upset in his spirit and greatly troubled. So he's upset because they're upset. He knows what's going to happen to Lazarus. You're right. So he's not crying for Lazarus, necessarily. He's crying for the sisters. Yeah. Good point. Yeah, Carol.
Oh, I have an ESV, you know, Lutheran Study Bible, and it says that another reason why Jesus might have been irritated is because the mourners wept as without hope.
Yeah, right. They don't understand that he is the life. He is the resurrection and the life, and he's going to overcome all of this. Right, so they lack hope. Yeah. Bob?
Is it the same type of weeping and sympathy as Jesus cried over Jerusalem, Jerusalem?
Yes, right. When Jesus cried over Jerusalem, that would also be the kruo, shedding tears, not plio, openly sobbing or bawling. Yeah. We don't really use the word weep anymore, do we? In English?
Not
really. Anytime I would say something like, what'd you say?
Only when you're talking about willows.
Oh, willows. Weeping willows. Very good. Very good. I would say more often we just say the word cry.
Yeah.
And cry can also be either, right? It can be open and vocal and, you know, and more pronounced, or it can be just shedding tears. So cry works both ways too. So, but in Greek they have the two different words for it. So just to bring that up for you. It just kind of sets the image in your mind, maybe, that the sisters and the mourners with her are openly sobbing and bawling, and Jesus is shedding tears for them because he's so moved by the situation. Okay. Questions or comments? All right. So the Jews said, see how he loved him? But some of them said, could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying? Third time now, Jesus has been accused of, why weren't you here in time? You could have done something. I think there's a practical lesson right here. A very pronounced application to all of us. There are many times that we pray for something. God, do this. Jesus, do this. And God doesn't respond. And we say, why isn't God answering this? You know, I'm praying for health or a financial situation or a relationship issue. Why isn't God help? Maybe, quite often, Jesus has something greater in mind for you in the future. So, Mary and Martha, in essence, you can say, they prayed to Jesus because they sent a messenger to him to say, Lazarus is ill, hint, hint, please come and help us. That was a prayer. Jesus didn't come right away. We pray, God help us in this situation or that situation, and you don't hear anything yet. It's because God has bigger plans for you in the future. Okay? Whether the future being a few days from now, a few months from now, a few years from now, or eternity. God has bigger plans for you in the future. That kind of gets back to that whole Jeremiah verse. I know the plans I have for you. Okay? So it kind of relates to that. Right, was there a hand up back here? Oh, Debbie.
Oh, I was just going to comment. God's timing is always perfect.
Yeah.
And it's by faith that we trust that.
Yeah, right. Right. And that's hard sometimes. That's very hard sometimes. Yeah, Bob?
Me and my crazy analogy. It was three times that he was said that this man would not have died. And it was three times that Peter denied Christ.
Yeah.
And so there was still something coming after Peter's denial, and there's still something coming after these three denials.
Yeah, that's right. Very good. Yeah, that's a good connection. I agree. Tom?
I was just thinking about when Jesus changed water into wine. Remember when his mother came up and said, you know, we've run out of wine, and he says, my time has not come yet.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, it wasn't his plan.
Right.
But then when his mother pleaded with him, then he did.
Yeah.
But in this case, too, maybe, could it be that maybe it really wasn't his plan to raise him from the dead, but when he heard all the weeping and he was himself moved,
yeah,
that possibly, I mean, he knew it was going to happen, but maybe it wasn't like his perfect plan.
Well, yes. Maybe the timing changed because he saw he was moved by their weeping. He knew from the moment he heard the word that Lazarus was ill that he was going to raise Lazarus. That's why he lingered for 2 days before he even came there. So he knew in advance he was going to raise Lazarus from the dead. He was waiting for Lazarus to die. That's why he waited 2 days, because he was about to perform the greatest miracle ever. In terms of the timing of it, you're right. Maybe that changed a little bit in here. Yeah, that could be. Linda?
He could have just said, when they sent the messenger from Mary and Martha, okay, he's healed, go home.
Yes.
But he didn't. He waited 2 more days, and then he wanted to show people.
Yes.
And that he was connected to that, because you could heal somebody from someplace else, but it won't have that connection to the person who's done it or why they've done it.
That is an excellent point. Somebody last night made the same point. When Jesus got the word, he's over in by the Jordan somewhere, so think Jericho, he got the word that Lazarus was ill. He could have simply spoke and healed Lazarus. He did that with the centurion's servant, remember?
Yeah.
And he didn't. Why didn't he just speak and cure and heal Lazarus at that time? Because he knows his time is approaching. So he's going to do this one in person, and it's going to be the greatest miracle, and it's just outside of Jerusalem. So it's going to be heard about. Again, the timing, I talked about this last week. This event of Lazarus takes place sometime right before Holy Week. You'll see when we get to the end of this passage, it says the Passover is at hand. Well, what does that mean? That means the Passover is close enough that people are starting to prepare for it. So my interpretation, I would say this, different scholars, you know, whatever, I would say it's 1 to 3 weeks before Holy Week. So that's when this is taking place, just a few weeks before Palm Sunday. Yeah, Ellen?
Well, we mentioned last week, too, that he may have waited purposely so that no one could ever say, well, he wasn't really dead.
Yeah, you know, right.
This way they knew he was dead.
They knew he was dead, absolutely. And this is going to be the greatest miracle he does, other than his own resurrection. And yes, you'll see as we get to the last paragraph of this little section, it absolutely hardens the hearts of the Pharisees, the Jewish leaders, even more, and drives them to want to kill him, even more. So you'll see that. You guys know the story. So that's coming, yes. One other thing in this paragraph, just a quick note before we move on. Last week we talked about the word love in Greek, remember? Three words for love, agape, phileo, and eros. Right here in verse 36, the word is phileo. See how he loved him. So the Jews, the mourners that are with Mary and Martha, are recognizing, oh, Jesus is weeping, shedding a tear, and he's moved in his spirit. See how he was such a good friend. And then they immediately contradict themselves by saying, why couldn't he have been here? You know, he would have healed them. So, you know, there's a little irony right there. Yeah, Linda?
And also tells in, is it chapter 15, I mean 11, it says, so that you may believe. That's why he held off.
Yes, right. Yep, we're getting there, absolutely. All right, moving on. Verse 38, then Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. So I already talked to you a little bit about the burial practices of the Jews, and this sounds very familiar because the same thing happens to Jesus. Jesus said, take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days. Remember that 4 days is significant. If you remember from last week, the Jews had this myth that the soul would linger in or near the body until the fourth day, and that's when it would depart. Also, by the fourth day, decomposition has clearly set in. It's become visible. It's not just the early stages. It's started in earnest. So yes, his flesh would have been starting to visibly decompose, and yes, there would have been an odor. Now this also shows Martha, is there a little bit of doubt here?
Yes.
She doesn't know what's going on, and you know, Jesus, what are you doing? You can't roll away the stone. Well, Jesus said to her, verse 40, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? Okay? So, you know, a little bit of a reprimand, a mild reprimand from Jesus. Just wait and see, he says. You know, you're going to see the glory of God. Now, remember we talked about the word glory also. Remember that? Glory, now just a real brief reminder, glory in Hebrew is the word kavod, which comes from the word weight, actually. But kavod, glory, in the Old Testament, the Hebrews associated that with the presence of God. The glory of God led them in the wilderness. The glory of God settled on the temple. Kavod, translated into Greek, is doxa. And doxa comes from the doxology, yes, glory. Doxa comes from the Greek word doseo, which means to think rightly, to think properly. So glory in the New Testament era means to think properly about God, to understand who he is and what our place is in relationship to him. And my argument is, put both together. So what is the glory of God? It's the presence of God in the form of Jesus. He's standing right there. And also, because of what he's about to do, he's going to fully, openly, in front of the crowds, right outside of Jerusalem, reveal who he is so you can think rightly about him. So you can start to understand who he is properly. The Messiah, the Son of God. So there's the glory of God standing there, telling Martha, you're going to see the glory of God, and it is I. That's what he's saying. Okay? All right, so they took away the stone, verse 41, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. What an odd prayer. Don't you think? I have always thought that's a weird prayer and an odd prayer. Well, after reading and preparing for this very Bible study, I no longer think that, because I discovered, mostly from Dr. Weinrich and his commentary here, that first part, Jesus is actually paraphrasing Psalm 118. And this is significant. So this has implication here. It's not as weird as you think. We're going to go to Psalm 118 just for a few moments and look at it. So, Psalm 118. Now, coincidentally, Psalm 118 is the last of the Hallel Psalms, which is Psalms 113 through 118, which were used in the Passover. What's about to come? The Passover. Three times in Psalm 118, it says, and in the ESV, it's not quite translated correctly. Verse 5, out of my distress, I called on the Lord, and the Lord answered me and set me free. The actual Hebrew word there is hear. The Lord heard me. I called on the Lord, and the Lord heard me. What did Jesus just pray? Father, I'm glad that you heard me. It's a very close paraphrase of this verse, which occurs three times in this psalm. So, Jesus is referring to this psalm. This psalm is all about God helping us out of distress. That's why it was used for the Passover. What happened in the Passover? They were in slavery, and God saved them out of slavery. Why did they use it in the Passover ongoing? Because of the same thing. We're still in trouble. They're still in trouble. And they know God will save them. So they used Psalm 118 throughout the Passover. They still do today, Orthodox Jews. Jesus is referencing that regarding Lazarus. Is death the worst problem we face? Yeah, there's other problems. Yes, granted. Death is the worst. Will God hear us and set us free from death? Yes. See, that's what Jesus is referring to here. The Lord heard. The answer there is, it should substitute the word heard. And I will also tell you this, just as a little side note, because it pops into my brain at this point in time when we talk about this. The worst fear that the Jewish people had in regards to God was silence. Some of you heard me say this before, maybe another pastor. I don't know. The time in between the Testaments, for 400 years, there were no prophets. And for the faithful Jews in that time, that upset them greatly. They would rather have a word of God, a word from God through a prophet or through a priest, that was a word of discipline or punishment for something they did wrong. They would rather have a word of punishment, because at least then God is talking to them. They absolutely abhorred and were upset by silence. They wanted God's voice in their lives, good or bad. They wanted God's voice. Do we want that today too? I think we do. Although I have to say, I kind of made this little tongue-in-cheek joke last night. You know, at those points in time where maybe I've had an argument with Jill and she's mad at me and I'm mad at her, I don't mind a time of silence. You know, that's okay. And then last night somebody said, yeah, but if the silence goes on too long, then it really starts to affect you and your relationship. Mm-hmm. And then it starts to bother both of you. And it can have significant impact. And that's true. That's the relationship between the Jews and God. For 400 years, they encountered God's silence. And so they were wondering, what's going on? Where is God? Is he still our God? So they would rather have an answer from God. So this is significant. The Lord heard and set me free. That is huge. Further, one more thing about this psalm before we go back. It's a psalm that is associated with the Passover, and it's a psalm about God's rescue. I don't know if I can find it real quick, and I didn't write it down. Somewhere in here, I think it's near the end. Ah, yes, there it is, verse 26. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Where have you heard that? Palm Sunday. Palm Sunday is a matter of 1 or 2 weeks after this point in John, after Lazarus is raised from the dead. Psalm 118 ends up being the psalm they're quoting when they're praising Jesus when he's riding in on the donkey. Some of those crowds at that moment, were they also part of the crowd that saw Lazarus rise from the dead? Undoubtedly, yes. So they heard Jesus pray Psalm 118, reference it in a prayer, and now they're praising Jesus with the same psalm. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Very curious, very interesting. Wonderful tie together. You know, I don't think it's a coincidence that the Holy Spirit made the whole Bible tie together like that.
Definitely not.
Yeah. Okay, Okay, so where were we? Jesus was praying what on the surface looks like an odd prayer. Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you sent me. So right there he tells his purpose within that prayer, and he's praying out loud for everyone to hear. Why is he about to do this miracle? So people know that he was sent from God. He is the Son of God, right there. Believe that you sent me. Yeah, Carol?
Just something else interesting about this psalm. Footnote again. In the study Bible says, this is one of Luther's favorite psalms.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I call it my own.
Yeah.
One of his favorite parts of
the Luther loved Psalm 118. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Read the whole psalm sometime if you want. It's a great psalm. Mm-hmm. Yes. All right. So he says that prayer. Might have there been more to the prayer? Yes, there might have been. But this is what's recorded for us. And yes, it's not as goofy as you might think, although, you know, on the surface, yeah, it is. Verse 43. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips, and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to them, unbind him and let him go. All right. Lazarus, come out. He calls him out of the tomb. I want to read for you a bit of a sermon from Saint Athanasius. This is 4th century, and it's recorded in here. Now, bear with me. It's a long paragraph like this, okay? But Saint Athanasius, it's recorded in the commentary from Dr. Weinrich. He's an early church historian anyway. But this is awesome. And the fact that it's been preserved since 400-something A.D. shows you how good it is. Most of this sermon, St. Athanasius is putting words or intent into Jesus' mouth. When Jesus says, Lazarus, come out, this is what Jesus is saying. That's what this sermon, this homily, is referring to, okay? So listen to this. When he had said these things, he ceased speaking with his father and turned to the body of Lazarus, which was lying without breath in it, nor movement in any limb. He called at the mouth of the tomb in his divine voice, Lazarus, come forth. Immediately the voice of Christ woke him who was slumbering, like a man who has arisen, who was asleep. He said to him, come forth. Behold, I am standing by you. I am your Lord. You are the work of my hands. Why have you not known me? Because in the beginning I myself formed Adam from the earth and gave him breath. Open your mouth yourself in order that I may give you breath. Stand upon your feet and receive strength to yourself, for I am the strength of the whole creation. Stretch out your hands and I shall give them strength, for I am the straight staff. I command the foul odor to depart from you, for I am the sweet odor of the trees of paradise. Behold, the prophecy of Isaiah the prophet will be fulfilled in you. Namely, I shall open your tombs and shall bring you forth. Open your mouth and speak with me. It is I who command you. Cast from you fear and know me, that I am the living God. Do not be frightened about the things which you have seen, for I have taken you out of their hands. Observe the place where you were sleeping, that it is full of pus and stinks. How have they come out of your body? Cast from you the corruption of the valley of death, as again you have seen life, which is I, who am standing by you. Do not be disturbed about what you have seen, for they are greatly disturbed since you have received strength and entered into the world again. Be strong about your ministry. Notice the place where you are standing, that you are inside a tomb, in order that you might know that I have taken you out of the hand of death. Observe the grave clothes which cover your body, in order that you might know that I have placed you in the world again after you had become a stranger to it. Come out of the tomb. It is I who command you. What an awesome homily there, a snippet of a sermon from St. Athanasius 1,600 years ago. That's tremendous. So anyway, I'm inspired by that. Sometimes I wish I could preach as well as the ancients, the early church fathers. But anyway, what a great paraphrase from Athanasius, yes, the same Athanasius who wrote the Creed, of what Jesus says here in three words. Lazarus come out, and basically Jesus is saying, I am commanding you, and you're coming out from death, and I am restoring you, and I'm giving you strength, and I'm the one who created you to begin with, and death be gone. You know, Jesus is saying all of that right here. It's awesome. Absolutely. The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips. Yes, you know, sometimes when I'm talking about this or teaching this with the kids, it would be a little bit of an odd situation. He's coming out like a penguin like this. Okay? He's bound. The spices have probably worn away at this point, so whatever odor was there, as Athanasius says, Jesus takes away the odor and restores his flesh. But he's still coming out bound like this, kind of wrapped up. Okay? And so he yells out, this is, remember, there's a dozen or so places in the Gospel of John where there's double meanings, double entendres. Here's one of them. Jesus says, unbind him and let him go. Who is he speaking to?
Devil.
He's, on the surface, he's speaking to the crowd. Take those linen grave clothes off him so he can walk and he's back among the living. But underneath that, he's speaking to death. He says to death, unbind Lazarus and let him go. And he's saying that to all of us as well. Jesus commands death. That is awesome for us who are connected to Jesus. Jesus commands death. Oh, what wonderful gospel that is. All right. Let's see. I think I'm caught up on my notes. Any questions or comments? Jerry.
I think we show a little faith. I'm sorry, show a little faith there. He could have transported him out just like he transported himself after the resurrection.
Oh, sure, sure. He could have.
Not like a penguin.
Yeah.
Right. That's not his name for year.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's very true. Any other thoughts or comments on this part?
Just the awesome power.
Yeah.
Power over death.
Power over death itself. The greatest of all miracles.
Yeah, when you sit at the bedside of someone who's dying, death seems like the big winner.
Yeah. But it's not.
There comes a point where there's no turning back.
Right, right.
But it's not, yeah.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
What John? It doesn't seem human that, you know, God can, in our way of thinking, that God can reunite the body with the spirit. At this point, people have been dead thousands of years, and their body is long gone into whatever, you know.
Right.
It'll all be reconstituted.
Yeah.
Even those people in Hiroshima, where they were vaporized.
Yeah, right, right. Absolutely. God can do all. Yeah. And?
So it strikes me when he cries out with a loud voice, and he's just using his voice. Well, that's just how God created the word. World too.
Yeah, right. With his voice.
He spoke.
Yes.
And the world came into existence. And
right.
So the power just from speaking those words,
right,
is incredible.
Yes, it is. God works through words, primarily, not always, but yes, most of Jesus' miracles were done just by speaking. Some he touched or did something, but yes, God works through language, through speaking. All right, moving on. Verse 45. Many of the Jews, therefore, who had come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. See right there. Martha told Mary secretly or privately, come see Jesus. And so then all the mourners followed her, and they saw what happened, and they believed in him. Hooray! Verse 46. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done, those little snitches. Yeah. What are they doing running off to the Pharisees for?
How dare they?
Yeah. Right. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, what are we to do? For this man performs many signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation. Yeah, there's a double meaning there, see?
Yes. Uh-huh.
If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. What they mean is this false prophet is going to get people to follow him and it's going to cause trouble with Rome. That's what they mean. But the truth is, if Jesus goes on with these miracles, people will believe in him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. And the greatest of all miracles, which tops this one, is about to happen. Mm-hmm. What do they mean by the Romans will come and take away our place and our nation? This shows you the motivation. Go ahead, John.
I'm just going to say they lost their power.
Yes. Yeah. This shows you the motivation of why the ruling Jews, the Pharisees, Sadducees, and the Jewish council, the Sanhedrin, why they hated Jesus. They were looking out for themselves, their own power, their own authority, their own prestige. If Jesus keeps doing this, the Romans might think it's a rebellion and they're going to come and wipe us out or take away our temple or remove us. You know, this is a problem. So yeah, it shows you their motivation. It's very selfish. Okay? But one of them, Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all." Now, before I go on, a word about Caiaphas. According to the Old Testament regulations that Jesus set up, the high priest was to be Aaron and his sons and their descendants. So the high priesthood was passed down father to son, or father to other son, or, you know, whatever, how it would go. By the time of the Romans, and it actually started with Herod the Great, they put themselves in authority over the high priesthood. So the Romans said, "Oh, you Jews, you can practice that quaint little religion of yours, that's fine. But the pinnacle of your religion, the high priest, is subject to us, and we will tell you who can be the high priest. And if we don't like him, he's gone, and we'll replace him with somebody else." And they did that. Dr. Weinrich has a chart in his commentary that shows all the high priests for about a 200-year span that encompasses the time of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And the Romans replaced the high priest every 2 to 5 years with a new high priest. So this is a way of the Roman government trying to exercise authority over the Jewish religion. By the way, this makes me think from church history and world history, how in the Middle Ages the Pope and the Emperor jockeyed for position with each other. The Pope would say, "Well, I'm the one who crowned the Emperor, so I'm an authority over him." The Emperor would say, "No, I have the armies, I'm the authority over you." And there was this constant tension between the Pope and the Emperors, and Luther was caught in the midst of that. That's part of the time of Luther, okay? In our humanness, do people strive to have authority over others? You know, one-upmanship, and I'm going to be authority over you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I don't want to get too far down this sidetrack, but is that happening right now with our culture and our government trying to take authority over the church?
Oh,
yes. Yes, it is. So it's a sad thing.
Yes, it is.
We're encountering this a little bit, kind of early stages right now in our culture. Okay? Yes, there are those trying to tell Christians what we can and cannot do, and so our religious freedoms are being eroded. All right, so that's a little bit behind Caiaphas, who was high priest. And he says, "You know nothing at all, nor do you understand that it is better for you that one man should die for the people, not that the whole nation should perish." Another double entendre, double meaning, right? Because what does he mean? Well, we've got this rebel, this false prophet out there named Jesus. We should kill him so that a rebellion doesn't get started. Uh-huh. It's better that he die and not that the whole nation be dispersed. Well, the truth is, that is the truth. It's better that Jesus die for our sins rather than all of us be cast into hell. So, yeah, another double meaning here. It's wonderful. And then John, the apostle, gives us the explanation. He does this again a half a dozen places throughout the gospel. So you can tell this is an explanation. Verse 51, "He did not say this of his own accord, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but also to gather into one the children of God who are scattered abroad." So you can say Caiaphas was a prophet, unknowingly. Okay? He was. And in John's little explanation here, what does he say? Not for the nation only, but also gather all who are scattered abroad. Who's that a reference to?
Us,
the Gentiles. We're part of this too. Absolutely. Verse 53, "So from that day on, they made plans to put him to death." See, right there, the Jewish leaders, the Sanhedrin, they started scheming right there. Well, they had already been scheming. They were further advanced in their commitment to kill Jesus. Okay? Right there. Now remember, this is sometime around 1 to 3 weeks before Palm Sunday, so it's fairly close. Verse 54. So Jesus therefore no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there to the region near the wilderness to a town called Ephraim, and there he stayed with the disciples. Now scholars don't know exactly where Ephraim is. There were probably a few towns, it was a common name, a few villages named that. But most of them think that it was along the mountainous ridge line north of Jerusalem by some half a dozen miles. Because that would put it on the edge of the wilderness. East of that ridgeline on which Jerusalem sat was the wilderness. It was dry and barren. West of that ridgeline, it was the mountainous area coming up to the ridge of the mountains, and that was pasture land. That's where they would graze. And then even farther west towards the Mediterranean Sea, that's the coastal plain where they would grow crops. So it's thought that this was just, say, a half a dozen or so miles north of Jerusalem right along the wilderness. Not that it really matters. But for a week or two, whatever the timing is, Jesus retreats again. He knows his time is now here, but his time is at the Passover. So he kind of retreats just briefly while he's waiting for the Passover. And we see that in verse 55. Now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and many went up from the country to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. They were looking for Jesus and saying to one another as they stood in the temple, "What do you think? That he will not come to the feast at all?" Now the chief priests and the Pharisees had given orders that if anyone knew where he was, he should let them know so that they might arrest him. Have any of you ever had an arrest warrant out for you? I doubt it. I hope not. Maybe you have. That's what's going on with Jesus. They put out publicly, if anyone knows where Jesus is, tell us. We want to arrest him. And why do they want to arrest him? Because they want to kill him. And so we all know where this is going and what's going to happen. All right. So that's where things stand for a week or two until Palm Sunday arrives. I have one other thing I want to talk to you about just a little bit because I think it's interesting and it's mentioned here. And we're at about an hour, so give me another few minutes. They went up from the country to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. This is significant to the Jews, okay? So this is what I want to talk about, purify. According to Leviticus and the commands that Jesus gave to the Jews back through Moses, back at that time, there were three states that you could be in, or an object, or an animal could be in, three states. The top one is holy. If you're not holy, you're common. And common is divided into two. It's clean and unclean. So the three states you can be in are holy, clean, and unclean. If you or something is unclean in the presence of God, it is destroyed because God is holy. Okay? Now in your natural state, you are in the middle. You are clean, but not holy. How do you go from being clean to unclean, or how do you go from being clean to being holy? By touching something or associating with something that is unclean or holy. So first of all, to look downward, to be unclean, there were many things that would make Jewish people unclean. And in order to enter the temple, which is God's presence, you had to be restored to being clean or holy. What would make you unclean? Well, touching a dead body. Touching a dead body made you unclean for a week. Or you were sick, had any kind of disease, or, you know, cold, or, you know, any kind of sickness that was unclean. There were other things that made you unclean. If you touched or ate pork, pigs are an unclean animal, so they would make you unclean. Okay, things like that. So there's lots of things that would make you unclean. Now, if you were unclean, how did you become clean again? Well, there was like four steps. First, especially if you were sick or you had touched a dead body, you would have to wash. Now, that's unusual through most of world history because, as you know, for most of world history, you had a bath once a year whether you needed it or not. You know, the whole idea of cleanliness next to godliness, that actually came from this idea. That God commanded his people, they would have to wash. So you'd go down to the river or the pond or wherever, and you'd wash your clothes and you. Secondly, you had to wait the prescribed amount of time. So if you touched the dead body, you'd have to wait a week, 7 days. Thirdly, you would go to the priest who would verify that you are no longer sick or you don't carry any communicable diseases. Touching a dead body could carry with it health issues, right? Disease. And then the fourth part was to offer a sacrifice to say thanks to God that he's restored you. You're clean again. And you can enter the temple. If you're not clean, you cannot enter the temple. So people who were going to the Passover, they wanted to be able to go in the temple and join the festivities. So they'd have to go early if they had been unclean for some reason. Okay? Now last night somebody said, well, what are you supposed to do if you're caring for a sick person or you're caring for a dead body for a funeral? Yeah, that's an act of love, because caring for somebody who's sick or wrapping up the body of a dead person and preparing it for a funeral for the family, you have made yourself unclean, or you have become unclean, and now you have just foregone your ability to enter the temple and God's presence for a prescribed period of time. About a week, generally, was often the time. Okay? So caring for somebody sick, that's a big act of love, because you're giving up your opportunity to go to the temple for a while. So it puts new light on, you know, caretakers, caregivers. All right, now, so that's going from clean to unclean and back. What about holy? There's nothing you can do like wash, wait, inspect, sacrifice. There's nothing you can do to go from clean to going to being holy. There's only one way, and that's to have holiness put into you. So Isaiah, in the commissioning of Isaiah at the beginning of his prophet, of his book, he says, woe is me, I'm a man of unclean lips among unclean people. And what does the angel tell him as the angel is telling Isaiah, you're going to be the prophet of God? He goes and takes a tong from the altar of God and touches it to Isaiah's lips and says, see, now this has purified you. You are clean and holy. Go forth and proclaim. You can only be made holy by having something holy given to you, put in you. What do you have that's holy that you partake of regularly that makes you holy?
Holy communion.
The Lord's Supper.
The Lord's Supper.
The holy body and blood of Jesus put in you makes you holy. That is awesome. And yes, you know, the joke is tongue in cheek. You know, I know Sally and I have mentioned it. You know, you're no more out the door and you're unholy again. Right?
Stop it.
But, yeah. Yeah, stop it, Sally. It's all you. Yeah. And Sally and I have joked about this. She's asked, you know, yeah, you might as well turn around and come right back in and try and line up for a communion again, right? The Lord's Supper makes you holy. You cannot be in God's presence in heaven unless you're holy. Because anything less, you're going to be destroyed by God's holiness. That's why he has to restore you to holiness the way he intended. And who is it that ultimately restores us to holiness? Jesus. It is Jesus who does it. So there's a little bit about holy, clean, and unclean. And it was a big deal in the Old Testament, because it allowed them to be or not be in God's presence. And it has direct implications for our spiritual lives in eternity as well. Okay? Questions? Comments? Carol?
Hearing you say that, it seems like you would want to have communion at every service.
Yeah. There are lots of people who want that, and there are many Lutheran churches that are drifting in that direction.
So what do you feel like about that?
I would have no problem having communion at every service if the majority of the congregation wanted it. It does, some people it's practical, it's like, well, it makes the service longer. Well, yeah, it does. Some people are like, well, once in a while we want to do matins or vespers. Well, yeah, that's true, those are beautiful services too. You know, I have an opportunity to do that. Other people are like, well, it takes a lot more effort because then now the altar guild's on duty every Sunday. Yeah, that's true too, you'd probably need more volunteers. However, spiritually speaking, yeah, the Catholic Church has communion, they call it Mass, So what's just a different word? They have communion at every church service, right? Even at funerals and weddings, for goodness sakes.
Really?
So yeah, they do that. Frankly, the Orthodox Church does too. There are a growing number of Lutheran churches that have communion every Sunday. And I know some that have multiple services. They do communion every Sunday at a different service, so that there's always communion available. If you want it, you just have to flip your service. I don't have a problem with having communion every other Sunday. That's kind of been the American Lutheran tradition.
Right?
Right?
Yes.
And you still get it fairly often.
Yeah.
But if the elders and the people, enough people here said, yeah, we want communion every Sunday, I'd say, okay, that's fine. I'm not going to press it one way or another. That's just my personal feeling. Yeah, Mary?
There's a book called The Blessings of Weekly Communion.
Yeah.
It's published by CPH. I have read it. I have a copy of it. It's very interesting because he goes back into the communion practices at the time of the Reformation and all this, and even pre-Reformation. One of the things I remember about the book is that he writes about, I guess, in the Catholic Church, before the Reformation, many times they were having all these masses said, but there were no people there to give communion.
Right.
It's just,
why are you having communion if there's no people there?
Yeah.
Right.
So.
Yeah. But yes, there is a book about the blessings of weekly communion. Yeah.
Two comments. Mm-hmm. So the first one is, when you're bringing that sacrifice in, people know what you're confessing to, or so that people would watch. And if they didn't come in often, like on Christmas and Easter, if they had those days.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true. Yeah, that's right. All right, so I guess from the lessons for today, if you want to think about it, Jesus is the Lord over death. He commands death. And yes, there's wonderful details and bits in there. I love it when Jesus says, unbind him and let him go. He's talking to the people, but he's talking to death itself. I love that. There's one of those many double meanings throughout the Gospel of John. And I would also remind you, just as our little bit of side note here, about purifying themselves. You are made holy, not just merely clean, but you are made holy through the holy and precious body and blood of Jesus, which he shed and rose again on the cross and the open tomb. That makes you holy. So that is a wonderful thing. So just some little lessons for today.
Did the Jews practice baptism?
Yes.
Okay.
Baptism for them, however, was an entry rite for Gentiles to become Jews.
Yeah.
So if you were a Gentile and you wanted to become Jewish, you would go through baptism. Jesus broadened it. And that's why when John the Baptist started preaching, repent and be baptized, it was a little strange to the Jews because they're like, we're already Jews. Why do we need baptism? So John, in preparation for Jesus, started changing the nature of baptism, and then Jesus changed it when he was baptized. So yes, they did have a ritual called baptism. Yeah. Okay, other questions, comments? All right, let's rise and close the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good day.